Welcome to the Metaphysical Martini Show, where wit and wisdom come together to bridge the gap between the spirit realm and the physical world.
With Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Ani Avedisian. Welcome to Metaphysical Martini. Three parts spirit, one part rational mind. Add two drops of optimism, give it all a good hard shake and pour, dress it with the olives of grace and empathy. Sit back, sip slowly, and contemplate the wonder of cosmic co-creation. And a hearty hello to everyone out there. Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for joining this crazy old lady as she manages to imbibe yet another round of cocktails on this week's Metaphysical Martini, the show that tries to sort out what's true, what's woo, and what gets flushed down the loo. In a world where, just when you think you've reached the realms of the ridiculous, Kamala Harris Ding Dong makes another attempt at coherent speech. FEMA can pretend it's hiding, but it needs a formal chiding. It gave illegals our tax dollars while Americans drowned in their Appalachian hollers. FEMA stopped locals from helping locals, writing them off as yokels and making way for mega corporations while refusing to distribute donations. Is there anything worse than killing your own people for money? Only a sociopath would think such an action remotely funny. And the question that leaves us all hanging and wondering what to do, when the heck will we get that military coup? I run to my laptop, my darlings, every morning, hoping for no internet and the start of an indeterminate number of days of darkness. You know, I'm hoping for 10. 10 days of darkness. Apparently, we're not going to get that, according to people on the other side. But if I had 10 days of darkness, I could get a lot done in 10 days, you know, without having to take Zoom calls and phone calls and stuff. You know, I could rework my prepping supplies yet again. I could organize my full wardrobe, you know, which consists of 3 pairs of sweatpants, 2 pairs of jeans, and 4 hoodies. I could detail my car. I could steam clean my carpets. And best of all, I could catch up on my reading and some grooming. And by grooming, I mean eyebrows, darling, not children. Now, before I go on with the show, apologies for not going live as scheduled on October 9th. Hurricane Helene was paying Florida a little visit, and Cosmic Reality Radio is located in Florida. Luckily, praise God, they had no damage to life, limb, or property. Huzzah to that! Many others were not so lucky, and I assure you, history will not look kindly upon the weather manipulators. And I sincerely hope that Team American Unity rounds them all up and executes them for their crimes against humanity. Welcome back, Martini Heads. It's lovely to be with you again. And to all the brave people joining us for the first time, a very warm welcome to you. Be advised, my darlings, be advised, this show, such as it is not politically correct, and that's so we don't erode the intellect. We Martini Heads, we are spirit-centered patriots from all walks of life who share a common purpose, the restoration of the American Republic, and the utter and complete destruction of the ideology and machinery of the thing we call the Deep State, aka bad juju people. And by juju, I mean juju bean. Juju, juju. Darlings, we believe America has a sacred purpose, and that's to lead the world back to common sense, to common decency, to common courtesy. That's a lovely religion, in my opinion. And Martini Heads know how the world works. We know who runs it. We know why. If you don't believe a deep state exists, this show won't make any sense to you. So you might want to listen in just to see if you can entertain another point of view and see you might want to learn something. You know, if you have an open and analytical mind, because open mind isn't enough, darling. It can't think for itself. You have to be analytical. Then perhaps this show could serve as an exercise, you know, in how to control your emotional triggers. And as serious as the subject matter is, we do try to have a jolly good laugh with it, because without humour, we are lost. And also, was it Oscar Wilde that said, if you're going to tell people the truth, make them laugh or they will kill you? I don't want to be killed, not just yet. So what are we going to do on today's show? On today's show, we have quack questions, answers and comments. That is the meat of our show. And then we have a silly poem in our Pat of Poetry section. We have awesome American civics and history, and also a new segment, which won't be showing up every time, maybe every 6 weeks or so. It's Cosmic Onnies in Bibery Library, where I recommend a book that pairs perfectly with cocktails and, of course, mocktails. Now, darlings, English majors, hold on, hold on. I know imbibery is not an actual word. I know this because I tried it on Scrabble and was shamed for it. But hear me out. A place where you imbibe. An imbibery. So it's a word now. Merriam-Webster, put it in your next book. I made it up. I claim it. But there's no copyright on it, so feel free to use it. It would make me so very happy if everybody had an imbibery. After all, my darlings, metaphysical martini. That's where the Holy Spirit meets top shelf distilled spirit, and what a lovely combination that is. In fact, let me take a sip of today's drinky poo and see if it's a winner or a sinner. Hold on, my darlings, don't go away. Sipping is happening. Oh, that's rather nice, actually. Yes. And talking about this lovely drink, of course, the last segment on this show is the cocktail du jour. And, you know, I'll let you into a secret. I think that's my favourite part. Alrighty, so let's get on with the show. If you would like to share the magnificent morsels of your mind with martini heads across the known universe, send your emails to me, because nobody else will read them. Arnie@arnieavedisian.com or snail mail, Cosmic Arnie, P.O. Box 714, Wilsonville, Oregon 97070, USA. And please remember to tell me if and how you wish to be identified on the show, or I shall refer to you as omit personal details. Alrighty, darlings, let's shake up the fishbowl of perpetual perplexity and see what pops out. Shaky, shaky, I'm doing a shaky, shaky. And our first missive is from Raymond in Austin, Texas. Trendy little town, you know, for Texas. Texas isn't really trendy, which is good. I'm not into trendy. Anyway, Raymond from Austin, Texas says, is it true that Jews are to blame for all the problems of the world? Okay, I'm going to have to put a kibosh on Jewish questions for a while. Is it true that Jews are to blame for all the problems of the world? Raymond, not even the cleverest of Jews could pull that one off. All problems in the world. Wow, that is quite an achievement. What we have here, my darling, is a slight miscommunication or purposeful error or mistranslation or. Jews are people who follow variants of a particular religion, as do we all. Following that religion does not mark you as inherently evil with plans to dominate the world. Whoever put that bug in your ear was referring to the Zionists. And I do suggest, if I may, that you go back and ask them if they know the full story, or are they repeating something Grandpa Bubba Joe said every Sunday after church picnic? A word of warning though, Raymond, as you start your research on this, it is a deep and dirty rabbit hole. When legislation was presented to make denying the Jewish Holocaust a crime, that should have been a bloody great big red flag. Why? Why? Why just the Jews? Why the Jews and not the Armenians? Why the Jews and not Rwanda? Or Cambodia? Oh my God, Pol Pot. What an F up he was. Srebrenica. How about the Iraqi Turkmen? What about the genocide of the Yazidi? Does anyone remember Darfur? Oh, hang on a minute, what about the pygmies of Eastern Congo and all the shit that went down in Bangladesh, to name but a few? I have given you a mere sprinkling of genocides. You know, I think I've made my point. I'll just end up by saying, do some research. And the guy who sells you bagels is not your enemy. Rothschild and his gang, Zionists, they are the enemy. And they must be taken down and destroyed utterly and completely. What else came in this week? Let's see. Oh, yeah, I remember this. This one came from Branka, B-R-A-N-K-A, Branka, who lives somewhere, probably, but doesn't say where. And Branka says, Arnie, what is your prediction for the upcoming election? I know Trump will win, but how do you think it will play out? Will they let him win? Will there be chaos? What will happen? Well, Branka, it's not as if I haven't thought about it lately, but I have to say, I needed a few days off from the revolution to regroup and prepare for the upcoming civil war shenanigans. I would like to share somebody else's assessment of what I think will happen, because I agree with him, and also he's already written it. There's a chap called Burning Bright, who's part of Badlands Media on Rumble, and they're a bunch of young men who really have some interesting thought processes and rabbit holes they go down. Very intelligent. So if you like rabbit holes, these boys are indeed bright, and they will come up with some great angles. For those of you who are unaccustomed to deep dives, but would like to leave the shallows because you realize that, you know, hello, things are happening, you know, our nation is in peril and all that good stuff, you might want to check out Badlands Media on Rumble. I would say next to Cosmic Reality Radio, that's where you're going to get the good stuff. Now, in theory, there are, and this is from Burning Bright directly, I am reading, he gets all the credit for this. In theory, there are more possible outcomes than just three, but in reality, there are probably only three election outcomes that could occur in November. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but I don't think there is any way Kamala Harris could win a legitimate election. And we all agree with you, Burning Bright, on that. And he continues, I'm sure there are people who genuinely support Kamala Harris. These same people likely believe everything the media tells them. They believe social media and they believe the polls. They are able to convince themselves that the country needs change and that Harris would bring that needed change. They are able to block out the reality that Harris and Biden have been in power for the last 4 years, and four more years would actually be more of the same, if not worse. There are plenty of people whose minds have been manipulated and altered to the point they are incapable of discernment or reasoning. These Stockholm Syndrome victims will do anything to protect the people who keep them mental prisoners. This is the reality of things. But I strongly doubt there are still enough of these people to legitimately win an election for Kamala Harris. And I agree with you, Burning Bright, on that and probably just about everything else. Burning Bright continues, I suppose the deep state could choose not to certify a Trump victory, but that would likely do even more damage to them and ensure they will never hold power again. It's also difficult to reject the election results when you've spent the past 4 years going on about how secure the US elections are and ridiculing anyone who questions the results. That being said, one can't put anything past the deep state or their cult members' ability to change direction and accept anything they are told by their mental captors, even if it is the polar opposite of what they had been told up to that point. So the likelihood is that one of three election scenarios will occur. Number one, Trump wins. Huzzah! Despite election interference, Trump's support is enough to overcome any and all cheating that may occur, and he will be announced the winner on or around Election Day, and the angels shall sing, and America will rejoice. That was my little bit. That wasn't Burning Bright. Scenario number two. Kamala Harris, the ding-dong, is declared the winner through a rigged election. And because her administration is already in power, the stolen election will be steamrolled through as it was in 2020, locking up anyone who opposes the fake election results. And there's scenario three, according to Burning Bright, Harris wins a rigged election, is declared the winner, but a trap has been set and the election interference is exposed. Eventually, Trump is declared the winner days, weeks, or months after the election day. And we could all stop stocking up on ammo. That was my addition. Burning Bright continues, I agree with Elon Musk when he essentially says that if Harris is successfully pushed through as the winner of the election, America will be over as we know it. I believe Harris taking office in 2025 would likely result in a massive economic recession and the removal of personal freedoms that Americans have taken for granted their whole lives. I don't think it is an overstatement to say 2024 is a make it or break it election. If Harris comes into power, there is no going back. America is done. If Harris is inaugurated, I have no advice. It will be a free-for-all. This may come across as just being very negative, but I'm not saying I think Harris will be the next POTUS, just that it must not happen. And he continues, many people have heard about the 16-year plan. The plan was for Barack Obama to be POTUS for 8 years, followed by Hillary Clinton for the next 8 years. Obama's years would set up the Clintons' years, which would eventually result in the total destruction of America. Trump being elected is said to have thrown a monkey wrench into this deep state plan. Trump's team undid a lot of the damage done in the prior administrations. A second Trump term may have been the death blow to the deep state cabal, hence their desperate need to steal the 2020 election. If one looks back to deep state presidents, two-term administrations, most of the damage they've done has been in their second terms. You see, they couldn't do much damage in their first terms. Otherwise, they wouldn't get reelected for a second term, even with election tampering. In Bill Clinton's second term, we had the Monica Lewinsky scandal, ouch, that ushered in a moral decay in America. This affair between a 22-year-old intern and the 49-year-old POTUS created an acceptance of immoral behavior. The majority of America was okay with its president having an affair in the White House. What once would have been immediately, you know, forced a president out of office in shame was now just a comedic material for a late night talk show and their monologues. But imagine for a moment if President Trump had an affair with an intern less than half his age while in the White House. The same people who minimized the Clinton affair would suddenly turn Puritan before our eyes. By the way, Burning Bright continues, the Lewinsky affair started in 1995 and it lasted until 1997. The affair was publicly revealed in 1998. Care to guess what year Jeffrey Epstein bought his island? You guessed it, 1998. Was the Lewinsky affair a giant Epstein honeypot to gain control of Bill Clinton? Thanks for your question, Branka, and thank you to Burning Bright for the answer. I rarely quote others' opinions on this show because, darlings, we all know only my opinion matters to me. But I happen to think that Burning Bright is a very bright young man, and I wish we had more young men like him. Go with God, Branka. Have a great life. You know, and in my own words, there is no way we have come this far. Under rapid fire 24/7 and against incredible odds, just to sit back and say, oh, well, we lost to Kamala Harris ding dong. America must be rescued from these Luciferian cultist bastards, and the American people need to relearn sovereignty requires responsibility. We the people have not given the correct responses, the necessary responses. We have responded incorrectly to the assault on our sovereignty. And after what all the white hats are going through to make America great and healthy again and sane again, the least we can do in return is to be the type of citizen worth fighting for. All righty, I'll get up off my soapbox now. I do like my soapbox because I'm only 5'1". It gives me a few extra inches there to bellow forth. All right, let's take another question from the fishbowl of perpetual perplexity, shall we? Yes, let's do it. Come on. This is from Baylor in Culver City, who wrote in and said, listen, I am a man. Please note spelling of my name. Is everybody on the entire planet today worried about being misgendered? No worries, sir. I will not misgender you. And he continues, in the new golden age, which I hope we will enter, what types of celebrations will we have when religion goes away? Now, that is a jolly good question and different to what we normally get, which is lovely. So first off, Bela, masculine Bela, I don't think it will all just disappear overnight. You know, I don't think that's the way it's going to go. And I, for one, would be disappointed to see all that local color and cultural identity, you know, wash away. What we will see first, I suspect, is a massive internal shift within all the world religions. And there will be much house cleaning, editing, soul searching, and of course, the inevitable mismanaged marketing. If we are lucky, we will see all religions distilled to their core essence, which is we are one. We come from one source. What happens after that will be glorious, but I have no idea what it will be, really. I think we're probably going to see 40, 60 years of the internal shift within all the religions. And then people, as they become more sovereign, well, we tend to be less dependent on others. That's what sovereignty is all about. We're uniquely, you know, connected. It's a wonderful thing. Each and every one of us is connected to source. And all we have to do is affirm that. And sovereign beings don't really need much management. You know, very good question. Okay, back to the point. How people choose to celebrate will change primarily, I believe, through healthier personal and social habits. You know, no more mountains of sugar-fueled brain bombs. Oh, you have to have a profiterole. You have to have 10 cakes at your birthday. No more excessive alcohol consumption. Note I said excessive. Have a drinky poo, but you know, keep it sensible. No more going into debt to buy gifts we can't be sure anyone really wants. And then, of course, no more dreadful mall holiday decorations. Instant pumpkins and bats, just add water. Instant Thanksgiving cornucopia, just add water. Instant Santa, just add eggnog. You know, there is no real joy anymore, is there, in the way we celebrate holidays? Come on, think about it. You know, it's like install template, activate template, remove template, install new holiday template, repeat process. You know, we all live all over the world. It's a small world in that respect. Traveling to see family during peak holiday time is a nightmare. There's too much slog before and after the eggnog. Whatever form our holidays take, I believe we will have moved away from the excessive and shameful commercial assault on our holiday dollars. We could go back to simple meals shared with good company. The changing of the seasons is a good enough reason for celebration. And we should all get to a place where we recognize one another as gods in bods. Yes, we will be creating life on a level we cannot actually imagine now. And the warm, fuzzy feelings we get from cute reindeer and chubby Santas and Christmas gnomes smoking their little holiday pipes, which I'm sure are filled with good gnomish weed. You know, it sounds very odd to say, but in a different level of consciousness, in a much higher level of consciousness, I feel that we will think upon these things as somewhat infantile. So let's enjoy them now while we're still at a lower level of consciousness. You know, and that's coming from a woman who loves Christmas. Even though I'm not religious, I love my conversations with Emmanuel, and I love little fat gnomes wearing Christmas hats. Oh, all righty. I think we're doing good for time. Let's keep going. Let's take another question. Maybe we'll take more. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. What have I got here? This is from Jenny. Jenny lives just outside San Diego, California. And Jenny says, "Dear Ani, I don't know much about QFS or the next reset, and I don't have a lot of money either, but I do have some to invest. Given that we live in uncertainty, do you have any advice on investment?" No, I am useless with money. And if I had any, I'd probably just spend it. Jenny, no, I am not money market savvy. You know, I asked someone the same question in 2019. I'm not actually that useless with money. I COVID broke my business quite badly. You know, 2019, business was great. I asked somebody that same question. I've got a little bit of money. Where should I put it? you know, when you finally get enough cash to invest, you know, and then boom, COVID lockdown. So I had to shut down my office, live off my savings, and that was the end of that. Jenny, write to me again in 5 or 6 years' time when I've built up my savings. But I am sorry, you need a proper investment person. And by that, I don't mean like Edward Jones or some sort of high street bucket shop. You know, find someone tuned into how finances will be managed in the future. Find someone who isn't just going to sell you the gold, but sell you the mine. Invest in the mine where the gold was, you know, is going to be mined. Find someone savvy in that world. I know nothing about this. Such a shame. But have a great life, Jenny from San Diego. All righty. And I think for now, let's keep that the end of Quack. Thanks to all the martini heads for writing in. Quack is the meat of our show and the reason we started the show, to learn what percolates in the minds of we, the people. All righty. I would normally blow my kazoo at this point, but I am house sitting and my kazoo is in my house, not here. So just imagine the kazoo going do 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 do. And now, folks, it's time for a little pat of poetry. Darlings, after a hard day shamaning, I like nothing better than going home, putting my feet up, and enjoying a nice cup of tea or a small drinky-poo, and writing really bad, but occasionally brilliant non-peer-reviewed poetry. And I think we can all agree, my poetry, such as it is without peer. Today's offering is titled Tea, Why I Love It. And here we go. More tea and why I love it. A shot of bourbon hits the spot when times are tough and peeps are hot. But when it's time to really focus, a cup of tea is my mental locus. I am fond of builder's tea. So dark, so rich, so unlike me. On saner days, I like Darjeeling, lovely flavour, most appealing. I've never had a thing for green. The good stuff's expensive, the cheap stuff's benzene. Tea with herbs is not tea, but tisane. Well, maybe it's teas kissing Kuzan. If one is in crisis, add sugar to tea. It will stop one from buckling at both knees. If one feels good and wants celebration, all teas are good for all occasions. A shot of bourbon hits the spot when times are tough and peeps are hot. But when it's time to really focus, a cup of tea is my mental locus. Written by Annie Mad Shaman Abadissian, October 2024. As I said, I'm house sitting, pet sitting, you know, well, I was actually last week. And, you know, being away from home, albeit less than 30 minutes away, was just weird enough to make me reevaluate some of my habits. I drink tea every day, but I tend to drink it, you know, as I do other things, because there's always something to do, always someone to talk to, someone somewhere needs my attention, which it doesn't, but, you know, peeps think it does. So anyway, where was I going? Yes. Being away from home, away from my imbibery library, and all my reference materials and all my stuff, it forced me to be more focused. So once my work was done and the doggo was walked and fed and played with and washed and all of that, I looked around for my usual distractions, but they were not there. Oh my God. So instead I found myself sitting by the fire, doggo at my side, slowing down to barely a pulse. Then the most wonderful thing happened. I felt a warmth over me such as I have not felt in many years. And my inner voice said, my child, this is why I brought you here, for this moment. Not because the extra cash is useful, not because there was anything wrong with your home, but you needed to rediscover that still sacred place within you, the place where you and I recognize each other, a source. You know, it was a beautiful moment, and I'm so glad I had it, because it was like pressing the reset button for the biggest mental reboot ever. Darlings, the last few years, well, shall we just say it's been very hard on us all? Let's all take time to sit back, drink tea, and hear the voice of the divine deep in our heart's core. A cup of tea is a cup of peace, and we all need more of that. Yes, well, if I wasn't in the middle of my podcast, I'd get up and make a cup of tea now, so I think it'll have to wait. And now, my darlings, I would like to introduce a new segment, which we'll do every 6 to 8 weeks. You know, quite a few of you have written in and saying, you know, Ani, we like the new format and we like it all, but we loved when you did Plato Chips. We loved when you did Cryptic Mystic and the Wizard's Gizzards. So I think what I'll do is every few weeks, I'll bring one of those back. So we get them at least once or twice, each one throughout the year. And hopefully that will make everybody happy. Okay, everybody happy? Lovely. Let's go on. My new segment, Cosmic Honeys in Bibery Library, where I recommend a book that pairs perfectly with cocktails and, of course, mocktails and, of course, a cup of tea. Martini heads don't judge. If you're not a drinker, don't drink. It's not really good for you anyway. It should be done in moderation and infrequently. And, you know, something that surprised me and delighted me, we have a fair number of teetotalers in our group, but they still love to join in and, you know, play around. So I guess there's content in this show beyond alcohol that pleases people. And I guess that pleases me too. All righty. Now, where shall we start with my imbibery library? I'd say today's literary soul jerker is The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. Now, I hear you groaning, stop it. You're all going, oh no, not Russian literature. My life is short, let's move on. You know what, let me assure you that your lives will only improve after reading Dostoevsky, because he was a bloody genius. And if you wish to learn how to write character development, read this book many times and study it. So if we take a look at the historical content of The Brothers Karamazov, let's take a little look about what was happening there in the 1870s. So we had the Franco-Prussian War, and that resulted in France's defeat and diminishing power for France in Europe. It also led to the creation of a unified Germany. Russia remained neutral, you know, in the conflict, swayed by Otto von Bismarck's support of Russian plans to remilitarize the Black Sea, a move that posed a threat to Turkey. What fun. Domestically, Russia seemed poised for progress. Alexander II, the eldest son of Nicholas I, led a series of reforms to modernize Russia, including the emancipation of the serfs in 1861. That was big. And the 1860s to the 1870s, we're seeing there a period of scientific progress. We've got nihilists and monarchists, both enthusiastic about new discoveries in physiology, chemistry, paleontology, scientific fields. And there was progress in education and more gender equality. We were able to see more women permitted to attend lectures unofficially or even to enroll semi-officially, you know, in the courses in the universities. However, the Tsarist government chose to keep universities closed to women, missing out on the chance to make Russia the first European country to grant women the same opportunities as men, you know, to enroll full time and obtain degrees. So I present that so we know what's going on in the era that The Brothers Karamazov was written. And Dostoevsky spent nearly 2 years writing this. And it was published as a serial, I think in 11 parts, in the Russian Messenger from January 1879 to November 1880. And Dostoevsky, R.I.P., died less than 4 months after its publication, and it has been acclaimed as one of the supreme achievements in world literature. And for what it's worth, I agree. It is a masterpiece, but please set aside a goodly amount of time to read it, because it is heavy going. But what I really mean by that is this. The character development is something worth taking your time with. Let me give you a quick plot overview. So, you've got Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, and oh God, he's a bit of a wanker, really. He's 55 years old, a sensualist, a compulsive liar, the father of three sons, Dmitry, Ivan, and Alexei, from two marriages. He's also rumored to have fathered an illegitimate son, Pavel Smerdyakov, who he employs as his servant. And you know, Pavlovich, he has no interest. He shows no interest in any of his sons at birth, you know, and who are as a result raised apart from each other and their father. You know, Theodore, he just lives a life devoted exclusively to the satisfaction of his senses. No thought for how it affects people, who he hurts. He doesn't care. He's also completely lacking in dignity, even though he has a lot of money and he can learn how to be elegant and refined. And so the whole plot is about the relationship between Theodore and his adult sons. That drives the plot for the novel. So let's talk about Dmitri, the oldest son of Theodore Karamazov. Now, he's passionate and intemperate and very emotional, easily swept away, very enthusiastic, over-enthusiastic, and, you know, which he demonstrates when he loses interest in his fiancée, Katerina, and then falls madly in love with Grushenka. So I guess he's cursed with a violent temper. Dmitri is plagued with the burden of sin and struggles throughout the novel, and he has to overcome his own flawed nature and attain spiritual redemption. Oh my God, this is the stuff of champions. This is wonderful stuff. And then we have the middle son, the second son. Second son, always a popular choice, right? He's Ivan, also known as Vanya, Vanka, or Vanechka. You know, Russians have a very big country, and they're very fond of diminutives for names. So, you know, Ivan is also Vanya, Vanka, Vanechka, in the same way, actually, as Dmitri can be Mitka, Mia, Mitenka. Anyway, Ivan, the second son of Fyodor Karamazov, and the middle brother between Dmitri and Alyosha, or Alexei. A brilliant student, really has a lovely, exceptional, acutely logical mind, and he demands rational explanations for everything that happens in the universe. But as a result of his inability to reconcile the idea of unjust suffering with the idea of a loving God, Ivan is plagued by religious doubt, and he oscillates between outright atheism and belief in a malevolent God. His forceful arguments about God's cruelty towards mankind are compelling. But after they lead to the murder of his father, they drive him to madness. Are you not excited already? There's so much going on in here. Murder, mystery, people seeking redemption. And let's go to the baby brother now, Alexei. Fyodorovich Karamazov, also known as Alyosha, Alyoshka, Alyoshenka, and all other Shenka things. And, you know, the protagonist, the third son of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, the younger brother of Dmitri and Ivan, kind. He's lovely. He's lovely. He's gentle. He's quite clever. He's wise. Maybe, yes, he's clever, but he's wise. And he's loving. And he is the opposite of his coarse and vulgar father. He understands a simple faith with regard to God. You know, he translates his love for God into a genuine love for mankind. You know, and around 20 years old at the start of the novel that he is, Alyosha is affiliated with the monastery, where he is a student of the elder Zosima, which is another lovely character that we'll get to. So we've got the three brothers and the crazy father all going through their thought processes, you know, everything that's going to go on. That's the main thing. Then let's just mention a few of the others. Agrafena, also known as Grushenka, a beautiful young woman who's brought to the town after one of her lovers betray her. She's a proud woman. She's fiery. She's headstrong. She's sassy. And she's gorgeous. And she is a universal object of desire among the men in the town, and the source of much antagonism between Fyodor Pavlovich and Dmitri Pavlovich. They say she's promiscuous, yes, you know, but she's not. You see how people are? Because in reality, this woman is too proud to give it away. No. She devotes herself instead to increasing her wealth by making shrewd investments. But after she meets Alyosha, Alexei, the kind younger son, a hidden vein of gentleness and love begins to emerge in her character. Oh, this is just so exciting. I'm going to have to read it again. I haven't read it for 5 or 6 years. Then we will move on to Zosima. Zosima, the wise elder at the monastery, and he acts as Alexei's mentor and teacher before you know, he dies in book six. When I say book six, remember this was written in several parts for a periodical before it became one big novel. He's extremely intelligent and filled with an ardent and sincere religious faith. He preaches, though, a message of not dogma, 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 of actively loving mankind and actively forgiving the sins of others and finding ways of cherishing God's creations and being grateful for the opportunity of life given to us. The clarity of his faith gives him intuition. Because, you know, what is intuition? It's a side effect of your alignment with your God, your oneness with the allness. If you're tuned in, tapped into the divine server, it's a lot easier to have clarity. So the clarity of his faith, he's absolutely convinced he's God in a bod in all the right ways. And that makes him a very good psychologist because it gives him extraordinary insight into the minds of the people that he meets. And you will meet many other colorful characters in this book, all with their touch of darkness and madness and grace. Let's talk about, you'll also meet Pavel Smerdyakov, the son of Lizaveta and Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. Yes, Smerdyakov, oh God help me with these Russian names. Smerdyakov is raised by Grigory and his wife Marfa, and is made to work in Fyodor Pavlovich's house as a servant. He also has epilepsy, which was considered a curse in those days. And they didn't really know how to manage it. So he has a mean temperament and actually outright malice. Very bitchy little man, you know? And then there we go. We've got Katerina Ivanovna, who's Dmitri's fiance, whom he abandons after falling in love with Grushenka. We have Lisa Kolkakov, her mother, a shallow woman at best. But, you know, she's in there. Mikhail Osipovich Ratikin, a young seminary student whom Alexei considers a friend, but who secretly despises him. And you'll meet wealthy landowners, petty bureaucrats, famous defense attorneys, the village idiot who is female in this book, actually. You'll also meet Father Ferapont, who is a very severe monk who hates Zosima. And you'll meet Kolya, a bold, intelligent young boy who befriends. Ani is having difficulty with the English language today. Please wait while I reboot. Toot. He befriends Alexei, you know. You're going to meet the son of a military captain, Ilyushka. You're going to meet, so many people. Oh, my God. You know, man, this novel, as I said, was originally presented in 11 volumes, and it's still a page-turner. The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky, and you will have new insight not only on pre-revolutionary Russia, but we will all learn a thing or two about how to keep peeps engaged when writing a big book. And I think that's it for Kosmikani's Imbibery Library. Now, which cocktail would you pair with this wonder-filled masterpiece? It's a long book, and it requires many beverages, so I might suggest you start off with tea. And Russians love tea, so you're doing the right thing by drinking the tea. But I know you're also expecting me to suggest vodka, you know. No, vodka, cold shots of vodka, definitely something Russians love, and definitely has a place in my life from time to time. But no, not for this book. Vodka is a shocker. It's also one of the alcohols that, you know, can really lend itself to demonic parasitic attachment. So you have to, you know, talk to me about how to keep your vodka demon free. But for me, this is a tea and sherry book. Whatever kind of sherry you like, I like my middle of the road. So I will drink tea while reading it, but I will always have a nice glass of Harvey's Bristol Cream Sherry on hand to soothe my soul when the characters get out of hand, which, of course, they will. Because that's what this book is all about. It's an absolute page-turner. Oh, my darlings. Well, that was Ani's Imbibery Library. And just, I don't want to belabor the point. You know, alcohol, lovely. Have a lovely little cocktail. Mix it. make it fun, enjoy it, but get your life to a place where you don't actually need it. Okay? All right. Do-do-do-do-do-do. And now it's time for awesome American civics and history. As always, my darlings, I work very hard at trying to find the most obscure little nuggets of American civics and history and bring them to you. I'll put some big stuff ahead too, but, you know, mainly I want to get to the little forgotten histories. I like that. The little things lingering in the nooks and crannies of old civics books that went out of print years ago. And I have to say, I think you all know, I have an obsession with secondhand bookstores, used bookstores. Just put me in there, give me half a sandwich and a cup of tea, let me go, come back for me in 8 hours. If you really look in these places, it's a cornucopia of unwanted, you know, civics and history material. Go to the American history section. I'm always amazed at how many of these books are given back, you know, handed back. Anything to do with the history of your country, how your country is run, the management of your country, shouldn't be given away to a secondhand bookstore unless you have more than one copy. These are things that should be in our homes. All of us Americans, we should know the Constitution, understand the Constitution, and be able to, and be prepared to debate some of the, you know, the finer points of it. I think we really need to do better, people, because Kamala Harris is running for prison. I mean, I wouldn't pay her to clear out my pantry, let alone lead the free world. Okay, I think I want to talk about Shay's Rebellion today. And thank you to Washington's Library, Mount Vernon, for this information. Okay, a violent insurrection in the Massachusetts countryside during 1786 and 1787, Shay's Rebellion was brought about by a monetary debt crisis at the end of the American Revolutionary War. Although Massachusetts was the focal point of the crisis, other states experienced similar economic hardships. In particular, the Continental Army and state militia veterans struggled, as many received little in the way of pay or reimbursement for their military service. And among these disgruntled former soldiers was the Continental Army Captain Daniel Shays, who led a violent uprising against debt collection in Massachusetts. And the rebellion, it set the stage for George Washington's return to political life and highlighted weaknesses inherent within the Articles of Confederation. At the very beginning of our sovereign history, the United States emerged after Shays' Rebellion a stronger nation, with a new constitution and George Washington as its first president. Huzzah! Following the Revolutionary War, the merchants in Europe and America felt a need to rein in the enormous debts they were owed, refusing further loans while also demanding payment in cash for any future goods and services. And who can blame them? You know, this demand for hard currency, it causes a chain reaction, and it eventually placed the average American borrower under unrealistic schedules of payment, given the small amount of cash there was in circulation at the time. And as rural farmers began to lose land and property to debt collectors, hostile sentiments boiled over, especially among those owed payment for military service. In September 1786, Henry Lee wrote to Washington that the restlessness was not confined to one state or to one part of the state, but rather affected the whole. Washington wrote to friends such as Humphrey Davis and Henry Knox, conveying his alarm at the turn of events in the States, and in response received reports that confirmed his fears. So the protests in Western Massachusetts grew more tumultuous, and by August 1786, after the convening of the state legislature failed to address any of the numerous petitions it had received concerning debt relief, Daniel Shays quickly rose among the ranks of the dissidents, having participated in the protest at Northampton Courthouse in late August. And, you know, he stepped up to the plate, and his followers called themselves regulators in reference to a reform movement in North Carolina that had, if you remember, occurred 2 decades earlier. And that was after the state legislature failed to address the group's petitions. You know, Shays, he led organized protests at county court hearings and that effectively blocked the work of debt collectors. In response to the growing crisis, Washington wrote desperately to Humphreys, worried that commotions of this sort, like snowballs, gather strength as they roll if there is no opposition in the way to divide and crumble them. By December 1786, the conflict between Eastern Massachusetts creditors and Western rural farmers, well, let's just say it escalated. Massachusetts governor, it was James Bowdoin, he mobilized a force of 1,200 militiamen to counter Shays. And the army was led by former Continental Army General Benjamin Lincoln, and he was funded by the private merchants. And Lincoln's forces anticipated that the regulators, those are Shays people, would storm the federal armory at Springfield, Massachusetts, and were waiting when Shays approached the armory. And they were waiting with approximately 1,500 men. January 25th, 1787. The army fired warning shots, followed by artillery fire, killing four of the insurgents dead, boom, 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 and wounding 20. Ouch. The rebel force quickly faltered and scattered into the countryside. Many participants were captured, and most men, including Shays, eventually received amnesty as part of a general pardon. So February 1787, once Shays' rebellion had been quelled, Knox reported to Washington on Lincoln's successful operations, and Washington replied to Knox that on the prospect of the happy termination of this insurrection, I sincerely congratulate you, hoping that good may result from the cloud of evils which threatened not only the hemisphere of Massachusetts, but by spreading its baneful influence, the tranquility of the Union. Now, what did Shays' rebellion really do for America? What did it do for us? I mean, it failed. Did it fail, though? Did it fail? Was it 100% failure? The rebellion called into serious question the state of the country's finances and the viability of the weak national government under the Articles of Confederation. Shays' rebellion accelerated calls to reform the Articles, eventually resulting in the Philadelphia Convention of 1787. And the convention, as we know, elected Washington as its president and ultimately produced the Constitution of the United States. Huzzah! Thus, in no small way, Shays' rebellion contributed to Washington's return to public life and the creation of a strong federal government more capable of addressing the present pressing economic and political needs of a new nation. You know, guys and gals, and children, sometimes you've got to sit back and think about the guts and the grit that it took to tell the British monarchy to go fuck themselves. Really, think about it. The greatest standing army in the world, and if not the greatest, the best trained, and certainly the best provisioned of its time. And you suddenly decide you don't want to live under their yoke and pay their taxes. And you decide that you are the ones that actually did the colonization of this new great land. And you are the ones that put all the hard work, all the labor into it. And why should somebody else, thousands of miles away, call the shots? And how a handful of Americans stood up to the British Empire and its very well provisioned and trained army. And do we remember what happened to the Founding Fathers and the Framers? You think it was all glory afterwards? No. Many of them, they had their lives trashed, property seized. You do this sort of thing, the sort of thing that Trump is doing now. You do this sort of thing when the world is about to collapse into a dark and evil dream. You do this sort of thing when you say, what is my life worth if I can't live it the way that I want to live it? What is the purpose of having an incarnation? What is the purpose of going anywhere and having any experience, if not to spread the glory of God? If not to raise consciousness, if not to have shiny new experiences, mess them up terribly badly, and then realize that you've messed them up, relive the fact that you are source, relive it, remember it, and then embody it. and then move through multiple dimensions of awareness. What is the purpose of living as a slave? Well, the founding fathers and framers and all those with them knew this, and they understood this, and they were prepared. They knew they might be executed. They knew they might be trashed. They still did it, because we didn't come down to burn and crash. We came down to make a splash. Sovereign souls do not take orders. Sovereign souls do not have their lives managed for them. This country has been running without a government for the last 3.5 years. Well, actually, Trump is running certain things. But if in this last 3.5 years, my fellow Americans, have you asked yourselves, what the heck do we need a government for? I mean, things are still running. We're still going. What do we need a government for? What do they do? I'll tell you what they do. They tax us and then take our money and give it to other countries. We need to get back to the founding fathers' version of small, limited government that is responsible for the protection of the realm and maybe adjudicating some disputes between states here or there and, you know, just taking care of the foreign policies. The states need to have more power, and we need to get back to that libertarian dream. Well, my darlings, well, you know, we've almost done it. We've almost come to the end of the show. I do hope you enjoyed listening in as much as I enjoyed recording it, because I had a blast. I always do. But don't go away yet. We have a few more minutes, and I really want to share with you my cocktail. Today's real life cocktail was part of my Yuletide beverage research. You see, Christmas is coming. The goose is getting fat. Please put a penny in the old man's hat. If you don't have a penny, a halfpenny will do. And if you don't have a halfpenny, God bless you. I was raised in England. I love Christmas, or Crimbo, as we call it there. It's just a wonderful, wonderful time of year. And I usually start researching what cocktail I'm going to make on Christmas Day at the end of October, the beginning of November. And what I've come up with today is called the Nutcracker. And it's really lovely. And here's how you make it. You take 2 ounces of really good bourbon and 1/2 ounce of maple simple syrup, which is very easy to do. If I have time, I'll tell you. Otherwise, go to YouTube and put in make maple simple syrup. So you've got your 2 ounces of your good bourbon. Don't drink cheap bourbon. It's not worth it. 1/2 ounce of maple syrup, maple simple syrup. And you shake it with ice. Shake, 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 shake. Really good hard shake. And when I say ice, I always use cracked ice. You get a much better blend that way. And a hard shake, as opposed to a little stir, really integrates the flavors. Now, you've only got 2 flavors here, but really go ahead still and give it a hard shake, and then add 1 dash of orange bitters, 1 dash, and 1 dash of your regular Angostura bitters, and then stir it. And then what you're going to want to do is pour it into a glass. I like mine with 1 big ice cube, you know, but some people like crushed ice or whatever. So just pour it into your glass over your preferred ice. And some people dress it with rosemary. I don't dress it at all. It doesn't need dressing. This is really lovely, naked and on its own. This was a Metaphysical Martini, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio, to whom we are most grateful. Deep gratitude to Mystical Wares in Mount Vernon, Washington, for taking care of this show's intergalactic distribution. Your reward will be in heaven, Derek. Mysticalwares.com, online or on location, you'll be sure to give them a standing ovation. I am Ani, mad as the day is long, Aberdissian. Until we meet again, don't you dare comply with illegal and immoral mandates. Don't you dare disrespect your right to vote. Get out and vote, whether we have an election or not. And above all, if you don't vote for Trump, there will be no America to come back to. And you can't do this, darlings, and you've got to let the spirit inhabit the human.
You have been listening to The Metaphysical Martini with Ani Avedisian, the Mad Shaman, a production of CosmicReality.com.